Chapter 4. Bannon. Steve Bannon was the first Trump senior staffer in the White House after Trump was sworn in. On the inauguration march, he had grabbed the newly appointed deputy chief of staff, Katie Walsh, Reince Priebus's deputy at the RNC, and together they had peeled off to inspect the now vacant West Wing. The carpet had been shampooed, but little else had changed. It was a warren of tiny offices in need of paint, not rigorously cleaned on a regular basis. The decor is something like an admissions office at a public university. Bannon claimed the nondescript office across from the much grander chief of staff suite, and he immediately requisitioned the whiteboards on which he intended to chart the first 100 days of the Trump administration. And right away, he began moving furniture out. The point was to leave no room for anyone to sit. There were to be no meetings, at least no meetings where people could get comfortable. Limit discussion, limit debate. This was war. This was a war room. Many who had worked with Bannon on the campaign and through the transition shortly noticed a certain change. Having achieved one goal, he was clearly on to another. An intense man, he was suddenly at an even higher level of focus and determination. "What's up with Steve?" Kushner began to ask. And then, "Is something wrong with Steve?" And then, finally, "I don't understand. We were so close." Within the first week, Bannon seemed to have put away the camaraderie of Trump Tower, including a willingness to talk at length at any hour, and became far more remote, if not unreachable. He was focused on my shit. He was just getting things done. But many felt that getting things done was more about him hatching plots against them. And certainly, among his basic character notes, Steve Bannon was a plotter. Strike before being struck, anticipate the moves of others, counter them before they can make their moves. To him, this was seeing things ahead, focusing on a set of goals. The first goal was the election of Donald Trump. The second, the staffing of the Trump government. Now it was capturing the soul of the Trump White House. And he understood what others did not yet. This would be a mortal competition. In the early days of the transition, Bannon had encouraged the Trump team to read David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest. One of the few people who seem actually to have taken him up on this reading assignment was Jared Kushner. "A very moving experience reading this book. It makes the world clear, amazing characters, and all true," Bannon enthused. This was a personal bit of branding. Bannon made sure to exhibit the book to many of the liberal reporters he was courting, but he was also trying to make a point, an important one considering the slapdash nature of the transition team's staffing protocols. Be careful who you hire. Halberstam's book, published in 1972, is a Tolstoyan effort to understand how great figures of the academic, intellectual, and military world who had served during the Kennedy and Johnson years had so grievously misapprehended the nature of the Vietnam War and mishandled its prosecution. The Best and the Brightest was a cautionary tale about the 1960s establishment, the precursor of the establishment that Trump and Bannon were now so aggressively challenging. But the book also served as a reverential guide to the establishment. For the 1970s generation of future policy experts, would-be world leaders, and Ivy League journalists aiming for big-time careers, though it was Bannon's generation, he was far outside this self-selected elite circle. The Best and the Brightest was a handbook about the characteristics of American power and the roots to it. Not just the right schools and right backgrounds, although that too, but the attitudes, conceits, affect, and language that would be most conducive to finding your way into the American power structure. Many saw the book as a set of prescriptions about how to get ahead, rather than, as intended, what not to do when you are ahead. The Best and the Brightest described the people who should be in power. A college-age Barack Obama was smitten with the book, as was Rhodes Scholar Bill Clinton. Halberstam's book defined the look and feel of White House power, his language resonant and imposing, and often boffo-pompous, had set the tone for the next half century of official presidential journalism. Even scandalous or unsuccessful tenants of the White House were treated as unique figures who had risen to the greatest heights after mastering a Darwinian political process. Bob Woodward, who helped bring Nixon down and who himself became a figure of unchallengeable presidential myth-making, wrote a long shelf of books in which even the most misguided presidential actions seemed part of an epical march of ultimate responsibility and life-and-death decision-making. Only the most hard-hearted reader would not entertain a daydream in which he or she was not part of this awesome pageant. Steve Bannon was such a daydreamer. But if Halberstam defined the presidential mean, Trump defied it and defiled it. Not a single attribute would place him credibly in the revered circle of American presidential character and power, which was, in a curious reversal of the book's premise, just what created Steve Bannon's opportunity. The less likely a presidential candidate is, the more unlikely and often inexperienced his aides are. That is, an unlikely candidate can attract only unlikely aides, as the likely ones go to the more likely candidates. When an unlikely candidate wins, and as outsiders become ever more the quadrennial flavor of the month, the more likely an unlikely candidate is to get elected, ever more peculiar people fill the White House. Of course, a point about the Halberstam book and about the Trump campaign was that the most obvious players make grievous mistakes too. Hence, in the Trump narrative, unlikely players far outside the establishment hold the true genius. Still, few have been more unlikely than Steve Bannon. At 63, Bannon took his first formal job in politics when he joined the Trump campaign. Chief strategist, his title in the new administration, was his first job not just in the federal government, but in the public sector. "Strategist," scoffed Roger Stone, who, before Bannon, had been one of Trump's chief strategists. Other than Trump himself, Bannon was certainly the oldest, inexperienced person ever to work in the White House. It was a flaky career that got him here. Catholic school in Richmond, Virginia, then a local college, Virginia Tech, then 7 years in the Navy, a lieutenant on ship duty, and then in the Pentagon. While on active duty, he got a master's degree at Georgetown School of Foreign Service, but then he washed out of his naval career. Then an MBA from Harvard Business School, then 4 years as an investment banker at Goldman Sachs, his final 2 years focusing on the media industry in Los Angeles, but not rising above a mid-level position. In 1990, at the age of 37, Bannon entered peripatetic entrepreneurhood under the auspices of Bannon and Company, a financial advisory firm to the entertainment industry. This was something of a hustler's shell company, hanging out a shingle in an industry with a small center of success and concentric rings radiating out of rising, aspiring, falling, and failing strivers. Bannon and Company, skirting falling and failing, made it to aspiring by raising small amounts of money for independent film projects, none a hit. Bannon was rather a movie figure himself. A-type, alcohol, bad marriages, cash-strapped in a business where the measure of success is excesses of riches, ever scheming, ever disappointed. For a man with a strong sense of his own destiny, he tended to be hardly noticed. John Corzine, the former Goldman chief and future United States senator and governor of New Jersey, climbing the Goldman ranks when Bannon was at the firm, was unaware of Bannon. When Bannon was appointed head of the Trump campaign and became an overnight press sensation, or question mark, his credentials suddenly included a convoluted story about how Bannon and Company had acquired a stake in the mega-hit show Seinfeld, and hence its 20-year run of residual profits. But none of the Seinfeld principals, creators, or producers seem ever to have heard of him. Mike Murphy, the Republican media consultant who ran Jeb Bush's PAC and became a leading anti-Trump movement figure, has the vaguest recollection of Bannon's seeking PR services from Murphy's firm for a film Bannon was producing a decade or so ago. "I'm told he was in the meeting, but I honestly can't get a picture of him." The New Yorker magazine, dwelling on the Bannon enigma, one that basically translated to, "How is it that the media has been almost wholly unaware of someone who is suddenly among the most powerful people in government?" tried to trace his steps in Hollywood and largely failed to find him. The Washington Post traced his many addresses to no clear conclusion except a suggestion of possible misdemeanor voter fraud. In the mid-90s, he inserted himself in a significant role into Biosphere 2, a project copiously funded by Edward Bass, one of the Bass family oil heirs, about sustaining life in space, and dubbed by Time one of the 100 worst ideas of the century, a rich man's folly. Bannon, having to find his opportunities in distress situations, stepped into the project amid its collapse, only to provoke further breakdown and litigation, including harassment and vandalism charges. After the Biosphere 2 disaster, he participated in raising financing for a virtual currency scheme, MMORPGs, or MMOs, called Internet Gaming Entertainment, IGE. This was a successor company to Digital Entertainment Network, DEN, a dot-com burnout, whose principals, including the former child star Brock Pierce, the Mighty Ducks, who went on to be the founder of IGE. Pierce was pushed out of IGE, Bannon was put in as CEO, and the company was then subsumed by endless litigation. Distress is an opportunistic business play, but some distress is better than others. The kinds of situations available to Bannon involved managing conflict, nastiness, and relative hopelessness. In essence, managing and taking a small profit on dwindling cash. It's a living at the margins of people who were making a much better living. Bannon kept trying to make a killing, but never found the killing sweet spot. Distress is also a contrarian's game, and the contrarian's impulse, equal parts personal dissatisfaction, general resentment, and gambler's instinct, started to ever more strongly fuel Bannon. Part of the background for his contrarian impulse lay in an Irish Catholic Union family, Catholic schools, and three unhappy marriages and bad divorces. Journalists would make much of the recriminations in his second wife's divorce filings. Not so long ago, Bannon might have been a recognizably modern figure, something of a romantic anti-hero, an ex-military and up-from-the-working-class guy, striving through multiple marriages and various careers to make it, but never finding much comfort in the establishment world, wanting to be part of it and wanting to blow it up at the same time. A character for Richard Ford or John Updike or Harry Cruz. An American man story. But now such stories have crossed a political line. The American man story is a right-wing story. Bannon found his models in political infighters like Lee Atwater, Roger Ailes, Karl Rove. All were larger-than-life American characters doing battle with conformity and modernity, relishing ways to violate liberal sensibilities. The other point is that Bannon, however smart and even charismatic, however much he extolled the virtue of being a stand-up guy, was not necessarily a nice guy. Several decades as a grasping entrepreneur without a satisfying success story doesn't smooth the hustle in Hustler. One competitor in the conservative media business, while acknowledging his intelligence and the ambitiousness of his ideas, also noted, "He's mean, dishonest, and incapable of caring about other people. His eyes dart around like he's always looking for a weapon with which to bludgeon or gouge you." Conservative media fit not only his angry, contrarian, and Roman Catholic side, but it had low barriers to entry. Liberal media, by contrast, with its corporate hierarchies, was much harder to break into. What's more, conservative media is a highly lucrative target market category, with books often dominating the bestseller lists, videos, and other products available through direct sales avenues that can circumvent more expensive distribution channels. In the early 2000s, Bannon became a purveyor of conservative books, products, and media. His partner in this enterprise was David Bossie, the far-right pamphleteer and congressional committee investigator into the Clintons' Whitewater affair, who would join him as deputy campaign manager on the Trump campaign. Bannon met Breitbart News founder Andrew Breitbart at a screening of one of the Bannon-Bossie documentaries, In the Face of Evil, billed as Ronald Reagan's crusade to destroy the most tyrannical and depraved political systems the world has ever known, which in turn led to a relationship with the man who offered Bannon the ultimate opportunity, Robert Mercer. In this regard, Bannon was not so much an entrepreneur of vision or even business discipline. He was more simply following the money, or trying to separate a fool from his money. He could not have done better than Bob and Rebecca Mercer. Bannon focused his entrepreneurial talents on becoming courtier, Svengali, and political investment advisor to father and daughter. Theirs was a consciously quixotic mission. They would devote vast sums, albeit still just a small part of Bob Mercer's many billions, to trying to build a radical, free market, small government, homeschooling, anti-liberal, gold standard, pro-death penalty, anti-Muslim, pro-Christian, monetarist, anti-civil rights political movement in the United States. Bob Mercer is an ultimate quant, an engineer who designs investment algorithms and became a co-CEO of one of the most successful hedge funds, Renaissance Technologies. With his daughter, Rebecca, Mercer set up what is in effect a private Tea Party movement, self-funding whatever Tea Party or alt-right project took their fancy. Bob Mercer is almost nonverbal, looking at you with a dead stare, and either not talking or offering only minimal response. He had a Steinway Baby Grand on his yacht. After inviting friends and colleagues on the boat, he would spend the time playing the piano, wholly disengaged from his guests. And yet his political beliefs, to the extent they could be discerned, were generally Bush-like. And his political discussions, to the extent that you could get him to be responsive, were about issues involving ground game and data gathering. It was Rebecca Mercer who had bonded with Bannon, and whose politics were grim, unyielding, and doctrinaire, who defined the family. "Like, whoa, ideologically there is no conversation with her," said one senior Trump White House staffer. With the death of Andrew Breitbart in 2012, Bannon, in essence holding the proxy of the Mercer's investment in the site, took over the Breitbart business. He leveraged his gaming experience into using Gamergate, a precursor alt-right movement that coalesced around an antipathy toward and harassment of women working in the online gaming industry. To build vast amounts of traffic through the virality of political memes. After hours one night in the White House, Bannon would argue that he knew exactly how to build a Breitbart for the left, and he would have the key advantage because people on the left want to win Pulitzers, whereas I want to be Pulitzer. Working out of and living in the townhouse Breitbart rented on Capitol Hill, Bannon became one of the growing number of notable Tea Party figures in Washington, the Mercer's consigliere. But a seeming measure of his marginality was that his big project was the career of Jeff Sessions, Beauregard, Sessions' middle name, in Bannon's affectionate moniker and evocative of the Confederate general, among the least mainstream and most peculiar people in the Senate, whom Bannon tried to promote to run for president in 2012. Donald Trump was a step up, and early in the 2016 race, Trump became the Breitbart totem. Many of Trump's positions in the campaign were taken from the Breitbart articles he had printed out for him. Indeed, Bannon began to suggest to people that he, like Ailes had been at Fox, was the true force behind his chosen candidate. Bannon didn't much question Donald Trump's bona fides, or behavior, or electability, because in part, Trump was just his latest rich man. The rich man is a fixed fact, which you have to accept and deal with in an entrepreneurial world, at least a lower-level entrepreneurial world. And, of course, if Trump had firmer bona fides, better behavior, and clear electability, Bannon would not have had his chance. However much a marginal, invisible, small-time hustler Bannon had been, something of an Elmore Leonard character, he was suddenly transformed inside Trump Tower, an office he entered on August 15th, and for practical purposes did not exit, save for a few hours a night, and not every night, in his temporary Midtown Manhattan accommodations, until January 17th, when the transition team moved to Washington. There was no competition in Trump Tower for being the brains of the operation. Of the dominant figures in the transition, neither Kushner, Priebus, nor Conway, and certainly not the president-elect, had the ability to express any kind of coherent perception or narrative. By default, everybody had to look to the voluble, aphoristic, shambolic, witty, off-the-cuff figure who was both ever-present on the premises and who had, in an unlikely attribute, read a book or two. And indeed who, during the campaign, turned out to be able to harness the Trump operation, not to mention its philosophic disarray, to a single political view, that the path to victory was an economic and cultural message to the white working class in Florida, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Bannon collected enemies. Few fueled his savagery and rancor toward the standard-issue Republican world as much as Rupert Murdoch, not least because Murdoch had Donald Trump's ear. It was one of the key elements of Bannon's understanding of Trump. The last person Trump spoke to ended up with enormous influence. Trump would brag that Murdoch was always calling him. Murdoch, for his part, would complain that he couldn't get Trump off the phone. "He doesn't know anything about American politics and has no feel for the American people," said Bannon to Trump, always eager to point out that Murdoch wasn't an American. But Trump couldn't get enough of him. With his love of winners, and he saw Murdoch as the ultimate winner, Trump was suddenly bad-mouthing his friend Ailes as a loser. And yet in one regard, Murdoch's message was useful to Bannon. Having known every president since Harry Truman, as Murdoch took frequent opportunities to point out, and, he conjectured, as many heads of state as anyone living, Murdoch believed he understood better than younger men, even 70-year-old Trump, that political power was fleeting. This was, in fact, the same message he had imparted to Barack Obama. A president really had only max 6 months to make an impact on the public and set his agenda, and he'd be lucky to get 6 months. After that, it was just putting out fires and battling the opposition. This was the message whose urgency Bannon himself had been trying to impress on an often distracted Trump. Indeed, in his first weeks in the White House, an inattentive Trump was already trying to curtail his schedule of meetings, limit his hours in the office, and keep his normal golf habits. Bannon's strategic view of government was shock and awe. Dominate rather than negotiate. Having daydreamed his way into ultimate bureaucratic power, he did not want to see himself as a bureaucrat. He was of a higher purpose and moral order. He was an avenger. He was also, he believed, a straight shooter. There was a moral order in aligning language and action. If you said you were going to do something, you do it. In his head, Bannon carried a set of decisive actions that would not just mark the new administration's opening days, but make it clear that nothing ever again would be the same. At the age of 63, he was in a hurry. Bannon had delved deeply into the nature of executive orders, EOs. You can't rule by decree in the United States, except really you can. The irony here was that it was the Obama administration, with a recalcitrant Republican Congress, that had pushed the EO envelope. Now, in something of a zero-sum game, Trump's EOs would undo Obama's EOs. During the transition, Bannon and Stephen Miller, a former Sessions aide who had earlier joined the Trump campaign and then became Bannon's effective assistant and researcher, assembled a list of more than 200 EOs to issue in the first 100 days. But the first step in the new Trump administration had to be immigration, in Bannon's certain view. Foreigners were the ne plus ultra mania of Trumpism, an issue often dismissed as living on the one-track mind fringe. Jeff Sessions was one of its cranky exponents. It was Trump's firm belief that a lot of people had had it up to here with foreigners. Before Trump, Bannon had bonded with Sessions on the issue. The Trump campaign became a sudden opportunity to see if nativism really had legs. And then when they won, Bannon understood there could be no hesitation about declaring their ethnocentric heart and soul. To boot, it was an issue that made liberals batshit mad. Laxly enforced immigration laws reached to the center of the new liberal philosophy and, for Bannon, exposed its hypocrisy. In the liberal worldview, diversity was an absolute good, whereas Bannon believed any reasonable person who was not wholly blinded by the liberal light could see that waves of immigrants came with a load of problems. Just look at Europe. And these were problems borne not by cosseted liberals, but by the more exposed citizens at the other end of the economic scale. It was out of some instinctive or idiot savant-like political understanding that Trump had made this issue his own, frequently observing, "Wasn't anybody an American anymore?" In some of his earliest political outings, even before Obama's election in 2008, Trump talked with bewilderment and resentment about strict quotas on European immigration and the deluge from Asia and other places. This deluge, as liberals would be quick to fact-check, was, even as it had grown, still quite a modest stream. His obsessive focus on Obama's birth certificate was in part about the scourge of non-European foreignness, a certain race-baiting. Who were these people? Why were they here? The campaign sometimes shared a striking graphic. It showed a map of the country reflecting dominant immigration trends in each state from 50 years ago. Here was a multitude of countries, many European. Today, the equivalent map showed that every state in the United States was now dominated by Mexican immigration. This was the daily reality of the American working man, in Bannon's view, the ever-growing presence of an alternative, discount workforce. Bannon's entire political career, such as it was, had been in political media. It was also in internet media, that is, media ruled by immediate response. The Breitbart formula was to so appall the liberals that the base was doubly satisfied, generating clicks in a ricochet of disgust and delight. You defined yourself by your enemy's reaction. Conflict was the media bait, hence now the political chum. The new politics was not the art of the compromise, but the art of conflict. The real goal was to expose the hypocrisy of the liberal view. Somehow, despite laws, rules, and customs, liberal globalists had pushed a myth of more or less open immigration. It was a double liberal hypocrisy because, sotto voce, the Obama administration had been quite aggressive in deporting illegal aliens. Except, don't tell the liberals that. "People want their countries back," said Bannon. A simple thing. Bannon meant his EO to strip away the liberal conceits on an already illiberal process. Rather than seeking to accomplish his goals with the least amount of upset, keeping liberal fig leaves in place, he sought the most. Why would you? Was the logical question of anyone who saw the higher function of government as avoiding conflict. This included most people in office. The new appointees in place at the affected agencies and departments, among them Homeland Security and State, General John Kelly, then the director of Homeland Security, would carry a grudge about the disarray caused by the immigration EO, wanted nothing more than a moment to get their footing before they might even consider dramatic and contentious new policies. Old appointees, Obama appointees, who still occupied most executive branch jobs, found it unfathomable that the new administration would go out of its way to take procedures that largely already existed and to restate them in incendiary, red flag, and ad hominem terms, such that liberals would have to oppose them. Bannon's mission was to puncture the global liberal emperor-wears-no-clothes bubble, nowhere in his view as ludicrously demonstrated as the refusal to see the colossally difficult and costly effects of uncontrolled immigration. He wanted to force liberals to acknowledge that even liberal governments, even the Obama government, were engaged in the real politics of slowing immigration. ever hampered by the liberal refusal to acknowledge this effort. The EO would be drafted to remorselessly express the administration's, or Bannon's, pitiless view. The problem was, Bannon didn't really know how to do this, change rules and laws. This limitation, Bannon understood, might easily be used to thwart them. Process was their enemy. But just doing it, the hell with how, and doing it immediately, could be a powerful countermeasure. Just doing things became a Bannon principle, the sweeping antidote to bureaucratic and establishment ennui and resistance. It was the chaos of just doing things that actually got things done. Except even if you assumed that not knowing how to do things didn't much matter if you just did them, it was still not clear who was going to do what you wanted to do. Or, a corollary, because nobody in the Trump administration really knew how to do anything, it was therefore not clear what anyone did. Sean Spicer, whose job was literally to explain what people did and why, often simply could not, because nobody really had a job, because nobody could do a job. Priebus, as chief of staff, had to organize meetings, schedules, and the hiring of staff. He also had to oversee the individual functions of the executive office departments, but Bannon, Kushner, Conway, and the president's daughter actually had no specific responsibilities. They could make it up as they went along. They did what they wanted. They would seize the day if they could, even if they really didn't know how to do what they wanted to do. Bannon, for instance, even driven by his imperative just to get things done, did not use a computer. How did he do anything? Katie Walsh wondered. But that was the difference between big visions and small. Process was bunk. Expertise was the last refuge of liberals, ever defeated by the big picture. The will to get big things done was how big things got done. Don't sweat the small stuff was a pretty good gist of Donald Trump's and Steve Bannon's worldview. Chaos was Steve's strategy, said Walsh. Bannon got Stephen Miller to write the immigration EO. Miller, a 55-year-old trapped in a 32-year-old's body, was a former Jeff Sessions staffer brought onto the Trump campaign for his political experience. Except other than being a dedicated far-right conservative, it was unclear what particular abilities accompanied Miller's political views. He was supposed to be a speechwriter, but if so, he seemed restricted to bullet points and unable to construct sentences. He was supposed to be a policy advisor, but knew little about policy. He was supposed to be the House intellectual, but was purposely unread. He was supposed to be a communication specialist, but he antagonized almost everyone. Bannon, during the transition, sent him to the internet to learn about and to try to draft the EO. By the time he arrived in the White House, Bannon had his back-of-the-envelope executive order on immigration and his travel ban, a sweeping, Trumpian exclusion of most Muslims from the United States, only begrudgingly whittled down, in part at Priebus's urging, to what would shortly be perceived as merely draconian. In the mania to seize the day, with an almost total lack of knowing how, the nutty inaugural crowd numbers and the wacky CIA speech were followed without almost anybody in the federal government having seen it, or even being aware of it, by an executive order overhauling U.S. immigration policy, bypassing lawyers, regulators, and the agencies and personnel responsible for enforcing it. President Trump, with Bannon's low, intense voice behind him, offering a rush of complex information, signed what was put in front of him. On Friday, January 27th, the travel ban was signed and took immediate effect. The result was an emotional outpouring of horror and indignation from liberal media, terror in immigrant communities, tumultuous protests at major airports, confusion throughout the government and, in the White House, an inundation of lectures, warnings, and opprobrium from friends and family. What have you done? Do you know what you're doing? You have to undo this. You're finished before you even start. Who is in charge there? But Steve Bannon was satisfied. He could not have hoped to draw a more vivid line between the two Americas, Trump's and liberals, and between his White House and the White House inhabited by those not yet ready to burn the place down. Why did we do this on a Friday when it would hit the airports hardest and bring out the most protesters? Almost the entire White House staff demanded to know. That's why, said Bannon. So the snowflakes would show up at the airports and riot. That was the way to crush the liberals, make them crazy, and drag them to the left.